Okay, so we went through the nine mental states. We went through the six powers. We went through the five problems and the eight corrections. Now you need something to meditate about. You know, at the last point of this chart, it says, Tawa Tsulwa. Say Tawa Tsulwa. Tawa Tsulwa. Way up here in the corner. Tawa Tsulwa means, that's the Tsul in Cell, Chaktel. Chaksala means prostrate, but it means to look for something from the hand of your lama. So tsala means to look for something. Tawa tsula means go seek correct view. You know, go seek emptiness, understanding of emptiness, okay? So we're going to now talk about the object of meditation and how to lead your meditation into an understanding of emptiness, okay? How to focus it on an understanding of emptiness. Today in the afternoon, we'll talk about the how you start, how you warm up for it, how you get ready for it. And then tomorrow we'll start examining emptiness. Well, we won't quite follow the curriculum, okay? I mean the syllabus, okay? I'm going to emphasize emptiness, okay? So we're going to follow the same object of meditation, the same instructions for meditation, but we're going to concentrate on the emptiness part, okay? There are three kinds of meditation. The English letters here are J-O-K, G-O-M. By the way, we had a really nice sojong. Today is sojong, today is the full moon, and which is the monks and nuns' purification. And they say when sojong is held in a place regularly, then the Buddha's teachings have reached there. That's the tse, or the measure of that. It felt really nice, and I hope we can do it more, okay? Say jogom.
Jogom.
Jogom. This is what you normally think of when they say meditation. Jog means to be fixed on an object, fixation. Gom means meditation. So jogom means a kind of meditation where you hold an object in your mind. For example, it could be a visualization of a lama or an angel, okay? Tantric deity. It could be emptiness itself, okay? And what it means is you are not engaging in a discussion in your mind. You are not reviewing something. You are simply fixing your mind on that object. With a visualization, you're trying to make it as alive as you can, okay? And with emptiness, after you've gone through some kind of process of thinking about emptiness, you're holding your mind on the result of that process, okay? And that's called jogom, okay? Fixing your mind on a single object and holding it there, okay? And that's what you normally think of when they say meditation. Say shargom, S-H-A-R-G-O-M. I'll get to the question later, okay? Say shargom.
Shargom.
Shargom. Shargom means, shar means for something to, a picture to come up in your mind and the images of a series of pictures coming up in your mind, okay? Shargom means a review meditation. It means that, for example, you would review the nine stages, the nine mental states, over and over and over again. You know, say, and it's kind of, you bring up the first, oh, jokpa, right? Sem jokpa, to place the mind on the object. And then you go nyewa jokpa, and then lende jokpa, nyewa jokpa. And you bring them up one by one in your mind, gyunda jokpa, and you examine them one by one. It's like playing a movie back over and over again, okay? That's called shargom. And that, Jetsun Kapa, people told him, oh, that's not meditation because you're thinking about it. He said, come on, you know, meditation just means one point in mind. You can think about it and bring up these images one by one. My Lama likes to quote a discussion he had with Kyabje Tijia Rinpoche, his root Lama, teacher of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and the one who designed this chart, actually. Although there were other versions of this chart, he just did it more clearly, okay? And he said, you know, you told us about these tantric sadhanas. We're supposed to see these visualizations go one after another, you know, one after another. It's like too much, you know. I want to develop single point of concentration. I don't want to have a whole movie going on in my mind, like 20 scenes, one after another. You know, how can you develop one point of concentration on 20 different scenes going by? And Kyoji Chichen Rinpoche said, the whole movie is one object. You see what I mean? Like if you see the same movie over and over again, you can develop a habituation, or you can get used to that object. And so Chichen Rinpoche said, don't you get it? The whole movie is one object, you see? It has different scenes, but it's one object. So Shargom is one of the three important types of meditation, and you have to learn to do it. So Shargom means reviewing one by one, like you could review the points of the Lam Rim, for example. Okay, all the points of Buddhist practice, one by one. And that would be a Shargom. Yeah?
But yesterday you said that for our 1 hour day that doesn't count.
I did say that. Okay. Personally, I think at our level, you know, Jokom, if you want to develop shamatha, probably Jokom is faster and Jokom is easier. It doesn't mean you can't develop shamatha towards a Lam Rim outline, but I think it's easier if you do Shargom, Jokom, okay? Yeah. This is C-H-E-G-O-M, C-H-E-G-O-M. Say Chegom.
Chegom.
Che means to analyze something, to examine something, to tear it apart. And in the scriptures it says, normally, this is like problem-solving meditation. Problem-solving is probably a good translation for it. You take a problem in your mind, and you take the pros and the cons, a spiritual problem, and you put the pros here and you put the cons there, and then you fight it out, duke it out. You know, decide which is correct, you know. And this is called Chegom. For example, a good death meditation would be a Chegom, you know. Over here you put the guy that says, you have plenty of time to practice, don't worry, you know. Average lifespan, 76 years old, you're only 45, you've got 31 years left. You know, and over here you have a death meditation state of mind that says, yeah, but do you know you'll hit the average, you know what I mean? And how do you know you're going to hit the average? You know, wait, what about that friend of ours that died when he was 20? And you know what I mean? And you let them argue it in your mind. This is very, very, very important. This is a very, very beautiful kind of meditation, because oftentimes a lama will say something like, you have to practice today, or you have to meditate now, or, you know, that. And then your natural state of mind is kind of lazy, and it says, no, I have plenty of time. I have to do something today. I have lots of people coming today. I don't have time to meditate. You know, one day out of a week won't hurt so much, you know. And then you have to take that state of mind, and you have to take the other state of mind, and you have to let them fight for a while, and have them have a discussion. Let them have a discussion. Socrates with his students, you know, a dialectic. And a lot of the books that are in the monastery are written this way. There's an exquisite book by the first Panchen Lama about emptiness. And over here is this guy that says, come on, emptiness means letting your mind go blank, watching your thoughts float by, you know, just sitting there and not focusing on anything, you know. And then wisdom is over. I guess he's got a red suit and a tail, you know. And then over here is this nice shining little angel who's saying, no, emptiness has content, you know, you have to think about emptiness. There's a lot to think about in emptiness. It's not just spacing out or thinking about something black or watching your mind for a while or something like that. Come on, you know. And then they fight it out, they start to argue. And this guy gets more and more subtle, you know, he gets more and more subtle. And like he says, well, okay, I admit that we should meditate like that sometimes. But, you know, sometimes you have other things to do, and, you know, and then it gets more and more subtle, and the fight gets very, very cool, very, very intense. And that's a Chegom. Okay, Chegom means you let two guys come in your mind and just ask each other questions. Okay, this is very good for practices that you have doubt about. You know, if you're not sure about some practice, like you hear some lama say, you should be doing this, you know. And then you have to go and sit down in your chair and discuss it with yourself, you know. And there's a special kind of obstacle to meditation that we're going to cover tomorrow at dinner. There's a special obstacle where it's called the Nyamong Chenggi Tetsum, where you're just lazy. You know, you're just lazy about deciding about this question. It's a serious question. Your life depends on it. Is it true what this Lama said about emptiness? Or was that other thing I heard true? That guy stands up there and says, washing your thought is not that much use. The other Lama said it was. Now, who's right? And you don't be lazy. Don't avoid the question. Your life is at stake. Okay? It shouldn't be just your first emotion about it. Debate it with yourself. You know, you got to find out which is correct. And let them do their arguments in your head. That's a good chegom. And it's very, very good for the practices you feel lazy about. You know, you think, I'm not quite ready for that. Or my Lama said I should do that all the time, but I don't think so. You know, fight it out in your mind. And if you find that you're not satisfied with the solution, go ask those Lamas. You know, what did you mean? Or can you defend that? Or, you know, you said that, but I don't get it. You know, and then if you do chegom enough, you'll find all the questions. You have a big pile of questions to take to your Lama. And good Lamas like it. You know, and they say, this is great. That means they're thinking about it. You know, that means they care about it. And if you never ask questions, they're sort of suspicious. Okay? It's like, you know, maybe they're listening or maybe they're not listening and maybe they're trying and maybe they're not trying. So, very good if you can reach a point where you are debating it with yourself. Also, you people in Italy and stuff like that, you know, when you have a... There's these two attitudes of going into the debate ground. One is, and I know, because I went through this evolution, you know, my first few years in the debate ground, I was trying very hard not to look stupid, you know. Like, my main motivation was, they shouldn't think that this American guy is stupid, you know. I should be ready, I should have all my answers ready, I should have, and I used to concentrate on the things that I was comfortable with, because if I could bring the debate around to my subject, which they do in the monastery, you know. Like the debate examiner will say, today we're doing Vinaya. Everybody has to talk about Vinaya. And suppose you studied Abhidharma, right? And you didn't study Vinaya. So within a few claps, you've got it twisted around to Abhidharma, you know. Like, do monks study Abhidharma, you know? And they say, yes. Okay. Well, what about this Abhidharma? You know? And you tend to avoid the things you don't know about, you know. When you get more mature in debating and you have more self-confidence and you're not so self-conscious, then you seek out, you bring to the debate ground all the stuff you're not sure about and you collect them together. You keep lists of stuff you're not sure about and you go into the debate ground and you say, I want to debate emptiness, you know. This guy said I should watch my mind and watch my thoughts flow by. This guy said that's not so important. You should understand how everything is your projection, you know. And I want to know which one is right. I'm really not sure. And the best debates are like that. Even your Geshe exams or something. Why waste the time? You know, bring up something you don't know about and see if somebody can prove it to you one way or the other. And this is a chegom. So, I mean, a good Buddhist should be seeking out the points that you're not sure about. And Galupas in particular, frankly. It's we claim, okay, to go after the parts that are hard, or go after the parts that are not clear, or go after the parts which are controversial, and let the easy parts go, you know, and they'll take care of themselves. Go after all the monastic textbooks are written in dialectic, Socratic dialogue, and they are fighting with each other about the tough points, and the easy points they leave alone, okay, they're not even in the book, you know, so, you know, as a Buddhist, you should go after the difficult points and do chegom. So chegom means go home and debate it with yourself, okay? And in the end, you find some solution, okay? And that applies to all your practices, especially your tantric practices, okay? I mean, they say, oh, you need to do that to get enlightened in this life. Am I really spending the effort on it that I should? Or am I sticking with the things that are more comfortable for me? You see what I mean? Like, all that tantric stuff is confusing. It's a little frightening sometimes. It's too heavy. You know, I feel comfortable with my, you know, I feel really good about learning the four divisions of, you know, like that. You have to learn the four divisions of so-and-so, but then as soon as you can, go to the place which is not so comfortable. Because then that's how you grow, okay? So the, you know, you've gone through the three kinds of meditation, and so if somebody comes along and says to you, oh, you're supposed to remove all your thoughts from your meditation, then what do you say? Yeah, no, what about jagom and shagom? Are those not meditation? You know, that is a kind of meditation. Those are accepted kinds of meditation. Kamalashiya, 750 AD, in the Tengyur, 2 volumes, 2,000 pages describing these meditations, taken directly from the Abhidharma, taken directly from the original sources. Come on. Is this something you just made up or what? You see what I mean? Dharma rumor, okay? And make them show you the original text, you know? Oh, just watch your thoughts float by. Don't think about anything. Have a good time. Relax. You know. You know, show me where it says that. Show me. You've got to... My life's at stake. Show me where Lord Buddha taught that. You know, show me the text where he taught that. You know, and you won't find it. It's not there, okay? You have to find some authentic texts, and those are kinds of meditation, and they're very useful. And all of the texts from ancient India, all of them, all of the Abhidharma texts up to the Madhyamika texts, all the schools say tu sam gom, say tu sam gom sum. I'll write it up here. In the English, it's tu sam gom sum. Say tu sam gom sum. Tu sam gom sum. Tu means, literally it means hearing, shruti, right? What it means is learning the instructions from your lama, okay? Learning the instructions from your lama. We're, very, very frankly, we are talking about thousands of hours, okay? I have students come to me and say, what are you teaching next class? I said, oh, we're going to do that little Lamrim called Yunishigim. I said, oh, okay, I heard that already. I'll do that other thing. I had my bowling league meets that night, you know, and I just wanted to make sure it wasn't anything I hadn't heard before. You know, it takes thousands of hours. I mean, I would estimate 3,000 hours or something like that. You have to hear it over and over and over again. There's something about the blessing of the oral tradition. And if you take the correspondence courses, it's really good. But it does not replace the oral tradition. There's a blessing of a human being standing in the presence, sitting in the presence of a human being, and having them teach that. You can't get that, although it's still very, very important to do a correspondence if you're stuck in Kansas City or something, okay? Nothing, not knocking Kansas City. Terpa means many, many hours of sitting in class, especially on the emptiness, especially on the subject of emptiness. And the idea that you could sit down without any training and see it directly is like saying you can be a concert pianist without having a teacher. I mean, it's exactly the same. It takes much more training to see emptiness directly than to learn to play concert piano. And anybody who tells you that you can just sit down and stare at a wall and watch your thoughts or something, it's not true. The Buddha never said that. The Buddha himself taught 50,000 pages on the subject of emptiness, and probably there's some reason why he did that, you know. You have to study it properly. And there's no Buddhist book from the Buddhist time or from India that says anything else, okay? Tu means you need to put in the sweat and the hours with a qualified person who understands emptiness especially, okay? You must find them. And you have to put in that time, okay? Say some.
Some.
And but I'm not being a sectarian. Bring the person to me. Let them bring the book, you know, by the Buddha that ever said anything like that. And I'm not being sectarian. I'm trying to save people's lives and my own, okay? You have to find a path which is authoritative, and you have to be able to demonstrate that it's authoritative. So, you know, ask them to show you the sources for that. You know, if somebody says, I'm going to teach you something special, say, great, where is it from? You know, and then have them show you the original sources, okay? Say samba.
Samba.
Some means after the class you go home and you rack your brains about it. Hour after hour you think about it, okay? Think about it. And it means a lot of reviewing and studying, okay? I have a lot of students who've taken, you know, 6 or 7 of the courses, and I've been to their homes, and it's really great how it keeps the dust off their shelves, you know? The dust collects on top of the notebooks and not on the wood, you know, and it's really good, you know. You know, they take it once and they say, oh, that's good, you know, I got that. Buddhist books are not like Western books. You don't read them through once to the end. There's no such thing in the monastery. What's the first book you study at a Gelugpa monastery? You guys are doing it in Italy. Nundogen, Abhisamangkara. Okay? How many pages in Tibetan? 50. The root text. 50 pages. Okay? The root text. Less if it's a big ring, you know? They spend 12 years in the monastery on that. Okay? It's not like it takes them... It's not like it takes them 3 months to read a page, okay? You know, it's not like they couldn't get to the end in an hour or two. You know, you can recite it in 34 minutes or something, you know, if you know it well. You can recite it in about half an hour. So why do they spend 12 years on a stupid 50-page book, you know? It's because you have to think about it. You have to contemplate it, and it takes that long to study it thoroughly, okay? So Sampa means contemplate. Go home and think about it, and review over and over and over. And very importantly, you should have a Dharma friend, okay? Some Dharma friends. My Lama had this good karma in Sarah when he was growing up. He went to the monastery in 1928, okay? He spent, 22-23 years there. And he was roommates with this person named Geshe Jambel Senge. And they sat there on their bunk bed and, you know, questioned each other night after night. After everything was over, they would sit there, they would joke about, when my Lama taught us Abhidharma, we named all the weird people in the community there different. This guy was Skanda, this guy was Ayadana, this guy was, you know, and we learned Abhidharma like that by joking about it, you know, and to have a good Dharma friend and to continually question each other, continually help each other. Most Americans, and I'm including myself, you're kind of like competing with everybody else, you know, like, oh, maybe I'll learn it faster than them, you know, I should know it better than them, or something like that. If you can get over that quick and get into this cooperative energy with each other, you know, where you're helping each other, you know, you question each other all the time. Hey, what are the 9 states? Hey, what about state number 4, you know? I had Brandy, you know, she's like, the other day, a year after the Bodhisattva vow, she's like, guess what, I'm having a lot of trouble with number 41. And I'm like, oh, that's really bad. What is 41? You know, and, you know, if you're with other Dharma students, you're going to get this exchange. And very sweet. You know, help each other. Question each other all the time. Okay? I think some of my students in, what's that park? Union Square Park. Debating during their lunch hours, you know. They come down out of the skyscrapers into the park and argue with each other. And it's really good. Okay? Say Gomba. Gomba means meditation. Okay? Take the conclusions from your contemplation, go into a place and meditate on it. Okay? Why did I write this up here? The point is that the process of spiritual development depends on meditation, on what you've contemplated on, and what you've reviewed from what you heard spoken by an authoritative source, okay? And that's the method that you're going to use to see emptiness, all right? So we're going to go into a text on emptiness, and it's a logical presentation, and you start out by doing meditation on each point of it, okay? And that's a meditation, okay? So to say that's not meditation is a mistake, and there's no book from ancient India that doesn't say that. I can show it to you in many, 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 many sources. Okay? I can't show you a book that says, you know, come to the Dharma Center your first day, sit down on a cushion, think about nothing, and perceive emptiness. There is no, I've never seen a book like that. And I challenge you to show me one, if you think that. Okay? This is the process. Since 500 BC, you know, learn it from a qualified Lama, Guru. You know, think about it, review it at home, and then go into meditation on it. Okay? So we're going to do this process. For the meditation, we're going to take Yundin Shi Gyuma. Say Yundin Shi Gyuma. The English here is Yundin Shi Gyuma. A little bit about the background of this book. You're going to get the English tomorrow. Yundin means good qualities, spiritual qualities. Even in colloquial Tibetan, Okho Yundin Chenpo Yore means he had a lot of education in college, you know, but it means good qualities, spiritual qualities, holy qualities, personal. Shir means the foundation or the cause or the source, okay? Sometimes she means foundation, sometimes it means the source of something, okay? Gyuma means that thing which is the source of all spiritual qualities, okay? Oftentimes they will name a book from the first line. Okay, they'll take the first line and they'll take the first few words and then they'll add the ma. And then that'll be the name of the book. You know, it's like saying, I pledge allegiance to the flag ma. You know, would be the name of the pledge of allegiance. You see what I mean? And that's how they name books sometimes. The ma is very important. We talked about it. In Sanskrit, it's the long I, like Bhagavati. And, for example, the Heart Sutra is really called the Conqueress, you know, the conquering woman or the conquering lady. And this is where wisdom is a feminine energy and a feminine principle, and very important in Buddhism also. For wisdom, for the understanding of emptiness, is all the feminine side. Okay, and that's seen throughout Buddhism. So it's kind of hard to translate, but it would be like, you know, the lady of the one who is the source of all my goodness, or something like that. Okay, something like that. Some boring translator say foundation of all my virtues, or something like that. Okay, but the point is that. Okay, that's the point of it. I'm going to write the first verse, which is the most important verse, and we'll go through it line by line. First, I'll tell you a little bit about the background of this text. I mentioned it a little bit the other night. It was written in 1402 by Jetsun Kapa. Jetsun Kapa wrote about 10,000 pages of scriptures. They say he was taking dictation from Manjushri. It's not hard to believe when you really see how much it is. You know, I don't know if he's taking dictation from Manjushri. I don't have that. I'm not at their level. I can't say if he was or he wasn't. But I don't see how any human being could write what he wrote. I mean, if you can read a few things in... Jetsun Kapa's stuff is hard. It's a very advanced. And I don't see how any human being could write that in one lifetime. He didn't live that long. And he didn't write much of his lifetime, okay? People think, when they think about Jetsun Kapa, they think he must have been sitting in his room at Ganden Monastery writing all day long. Because 10,000 pages works out to a lot, you know. Actually, it's very interesting. He spent most of his younger life debating. He was a gunslinger. He walked from East Tibet to Central Tibet debating every single monk he could find. You know, he was very precocious, apparently. And, you know, he was ordained in the east of Tibet at Kumbum, what later became Kumbum area, and then walked to Central Tibet to find his great teachers and study there. There's a beautiful set of tankas, 15 tankas, that summarize his life. And some of our students are translating those. They have little tiny writing on them, and they tell his whole life story. Very, very beautiful. So he spends most of his early life debating. And then he starts going into a lot of retreats. And one of his favorite practices was requesting the blessings of his lamas. When you do this gyudenge, that thing where you bring the lama up here, and then you feel them coming straight down, and you imagine this warmth in your chest and in your heart. He spent about half his time doing this. You know, people nowadays think this is kind of naive, or you don't need to do that much, it's more important to study hard, or something like that. People have heard about me explain karma. They say, oh, Michael Roach said lamas can't bless you. You have to bless yourself. So I don't have to do that practice. You know, it's not like that. He spent half his time meditating and asking other lamas for help. You know, in his mind and in his heart. You know, this guy writing 10,000 pages, building all the monasteries, major three Gelupa monasteries, Sera, Ganden, Drebung, all built by him or his students, which eventually came to house 30,000 monks. He was a busy man. But he took time out, teacher of the first Dalai Lama, but he took time out daily. He spent a lot, many hours asking for the blessing of his lamas, you know, visualizing his lamas, bringing them onto his head, and bringing them into him, you know. So get this, like he's got this urge. He would wander around Tibet with his students. You know, he had a group of 20, 30 students, sometimes more, sometimes less. They walked around Tibet. In the summer, they'd go to the cool places. In the winter, they'd go to the warm places, you know. And they would have a Dharma party, and they would spend 10 days or 15 days. He would teach a text. They would debate it. They would have a nice meal. They would restore a nearby temple together, work a little bit. And that was his idea of a good time, and he did that for most of his life, just wandering around like that, having these beautiful teachings. And so one day he gets this urge, 1402, to go down and see Radeng Monastery. This is like one of the original Kadampa monasteries, founded by Lord Atisha and his student Domtenje. Okay, and he says, I want to go down and see this temple. They've been gone for 400 years by this time, okay? Atisha has been dead for 400 years. And Jetsun Kapa says, I'd like to go see Radeng. Maybe I can pick up some blessings there, you know? And he goes to Radeng, and there's this, apparently, I've never been there, but there apparently is a hill behind the monastery, and there used to be a beautiful image of Lord Atisha there on the hill. So he goes down to Radeng. He's sets up his, they had sleeping bags and little tents, and he sets up his stuff down at the foot of the statue, and every day he goes out and he starts meditating in front of the statue and asking for the blessings of Lord Atisha. And then one night he's praying, and he goes into this intense vision, like he's on an LSD trip or something, you know, and he goes into this very, very intense vision, and he sees Atisha, and Atisha is talking to him, and then he sees all of the lamas who have taught the Lam Rim back to the time of the Buddha. Don't think Lam Rim is some Tibetan invention, okay? Lord Buddha taught it in a different form. It became to be called Lam Rim when it reached Tibet. But he sees all of these holy beings, Manjushri, Tenrin Singh, all of them, Maitreya, everyone from whom these lineages have come down, and he sees them directly, and for a whole month, camping in front of this image by himself, he's in and out of this hallucination, like he's not eating much, and he's meditating a lot, and over these beings are coming to him, and he's having these intense visions. He comes out of those visions about a month later, and the last thing he sees is Lord Atisha says, you know, Jetsun Kapa, time for you to do something of meaning. You know, you have to really help people. You have to do something important to help people. Think about it, you know, something like that. And then he's like meditating, and a bunch of students come to him and say, could you write us like a book like that would summarize all the Buddhist path from the beginning to end, like an instruction manual, you know, like this, do this first, do this second, do this third, you know, all the from the beginning to the end, you know. And he says to himself, that must be what he was telling me, you know. And he says, okay, let's do it. And he goes into seclusion, and he writes the Lam Rim Chamo. He knocks it out in like a very short time, 1,000 pages, the great Lam Rim, okay. And this is some amazing thing he's done. Right before he went into that, and that's the greatest book ever written in Tibetan, right before going into that vision, he did this prayer to Atisha, okay, like he's saying, he does a prayer to the three lineages of the Lam Rim, And he's getting really, really intense about it. And it's a long prayer, you know. The whole thing is called Jinlap Bungshu. Say Jinlap Bungshu. Jinlap Bungshu. It means mountain of blessings. Requesting a mountain of blessings. And that's this prayer that he said just before he went into this LSD trip. Okay? Jinlap Bungshu. In the middle of that, there's a little section about the steps, all the steps to get to Buddhahood. Right in the middle, he's like saying, please help me learn this. Please help me learn this. Please help me learn this. That's Yunishigima. Okay? Yunishigima was cut later, hundreds of years later, it was cut out of the middle of this longer prayer, and it was called the source of all my goodness, or the foundation of all virtues, or something like that. Okay? And so now you know the history of where it comes from, and you know what happened with it. Why did he name the Lama Rinpoche the Lama Rinpoche? We have tankas that show him finding another book that was written 200 or 300 years before him called Tenrim Chemo. Say Tenrim Chemo. Tenrim Chemo. This is by a Kadampa named Geshe Drolumba. Okay? And in Jetsonkapa time, it was rare. It was rare. This book was very hard to find. And we have a picture of him finding it. We have a painting of him finding it. And he taught it to his students, and he revered it so much that he took most of it and used it in his Lama Rinpoche. And the book's name was Tenrim Rinpoche. Okay? The great book on the stages of the teaching instead of the great book on the stages of the path. Okay? And that book, I'll tell you more about that book later. We're going to talk a little bit about that book. So you know the history of this book now. You know where the book came from, and you know what the book did for him. The book is very often used as a warm-up to a tantric initiation. Okay, this text has very often been used throughout Tibet as preparing the student to give them a tantric initiation. So it's one of the only Lama Rims that goes into any detail about Tantra, relatively. Okay, it goes right from Sutra into Tantra, and it gives you all the details you know, you need to know to undertake a tantric initiation. We have a record of some teachings that Pabongka Rinpoche gave privately to a small group of students on this text just before he gave them an initiation. It must have been in the 1920s or something. It was written down later. It was carved, and it was kept privately, and it was not released with his collected works. Like, we recently got a copy of his collected works. It's 12 volumes. It's huge. It's not in there. And then the third Pabongka Rinpoche, who's in our college, in our house in Serame, he gave me this text, and he said we could translate it and use it. So we're going to study that explanation of this text, okay? And it's very beautiful, very rare text, and a very sweet explanation of that text. So we'll be studying that. Take a break now, and we'll start the text after that, okay? Right. Yeah. A couple of other announcements. There's this sheet. I don't know if anyone didn't get it. This is how to do your offering bowls in the morning. This was put together by Ani Pelma, who's here, and Rob Haggerty. Come on. He did most of the work. They collaborated on that. And how do they get a copy? Should be in your book. If it's not in your book, talk to Anila. Okay. What book? It's. Oh, tomorrow afternoon when we discuss how to do the book, which we haven't found a name for yet, that'll be inside of there. Okay? That'll be inside of there. I have another. I get all these ideas about neat projects. Okay, I have another project for you. My old students are like cringing. We raised some mula for Land of Medicine Buddha with the posters. If you haven't taken a poster, you're welcome to take one, okay? Just come up and get one and just take it, okay? If there's more left over, Kinzom has kindly offered to split them between LMB and Vajrapani, and you can keep them here and give them away or whatever to other people who come later. And then try to come to the dinner tomorrow night because it helps support Vajrapani. So I think we covered Vajrapani, LMB. Now, tomorrow, we brought two cases of this book. We translated the book that I was talking about, Pabokramache's little book, and it has the Yunishigima in it also. And it's that instruction that he gave before the initiation, maybe 50 years ago or something, 70 years ago. And I really wanted you to have it because that will be what you meditate on, okay? And somebody from New York with sunglasses... has offered to sponsor all those books for free. Yeah. Yeah.
That's already covered.
Well, it's been paid for twice, actually. Okay, that's fine. No, we'll take all the extra money, but what I want to do is suggest that you throw in, like, some extra moolah when you get it tomorrow. We'll do the same thing again. Trichang Rinpoche, when I was staying in his house in the winter debates, we were digging through, I asked him if I could dig through his former life's books, and he said, I don't mind. And we went through all the books, and we found the Tenrim Chenmo there. And we don't know how he got it. We don't know where it came from. The only other copy is in Siberia. Half the pages are obliterated. And so I begged him if we could put it in the computer and publish it. And I came up with this idea. His attendant from his past life was still the attendant about 3 years ago. He's passed away now, Kumo Pelden. Very great, great, great monk and great man. You might know his daughter Namgyal in Delhi. And then I made him a deal. This is a diamond dealer thing. You know, I said, we'll publish it. We'll give you all the copies. And then you can support. They have like 20 older monks from the previous life who attended the first Trichang Rinpoche, who don't have any means of support. So he's trying to take care of them. He's a kid, and he doesn't have anything. So I said, we'll print it for free. We'll give you all the copies. And then everybody in the world will order one, you know. So we made that deal 3 years ago. I haven't had time to... It's been input. It's 1,000 pages long. It's fantastic. So... If you want, tomorrow when we hand out the books, give Perella a little donation for it, and then we'll take it to India and publish his book for him. And then that is the book. It's the greatest Kadampa book ever written, and it was missing. And we found the copy. So I think it's important that we spread it, get it back. And that is the mother of the Lamrim Temple. That's where the Lamrim Temple came from. So I think it's very exciting to rescue one of the great Kadampa books, maybe the greatest Kadampa book, okay? So if you're up for that, tomorrow I'll do that. Okay. I just talked Lama Sopa into one of those. He said his Lama was Geshe Rabten, and he taught him this special book by Jetsun Kapa, and that he wrote a commentary, and they don't know where it is. I said, Rinpoche, we typed it in at Sarah J. about a month ago. You want to sponsor it, you know? And he said, yeah, so that'll be coming out. Geshe Rabten, I don't think most people know, he taught a lot of Westerners in the time of Lama Yeshe. He lived in Switzerland, and he wrote a fantastic commentary on Chöngye Lekchi Nyingbo, on how to interpret the Buddha. So we're going to be studying that in New York in September, October. Yeah. Okay, here we go. So those are my diamond deals with you guys. We're going to focus on the first verse this afternoon of that text. Again, the object is to get, by tomorrow afternoon, is to get to emptiness, which is what you're going to meditate on, okay? Which is what you're going to use this big gun on, all right? The English spelling is Yunten, Yunten. K-U-N hyphen G-Y-I. S-H-I-R. G-Y-U-R DRINCHENJE. Okay. Say Yunden Kungi Shirgyur Dinchen J. Okay. Yunden, as I said before, means great spiritual qualities. Being able to see emptiness directly. Having a real experience of bodhicitta. Gaining renunciation. You know, understanding meditation perfectly. Gun means all of them. Shigyur means you are the source of all of these good qualities. Okay. Dinchen means kind, very kind. Person who has kindness. Okay, Dinchen. J means Lord, okay, Lord. Like Jetsongkhapa means Tsongkhapa the Great or Lord Tsongkhapa, okay. This is the first step in seeing emptiness directly, okay. Like you can, this comes somewhere later, like two-thirds through the text, okay, how to get to this white elephant here, okay. It's probably a white elephant sale we had. But the very first step in seeing emptiness directly, and most people don't think so, you know. They just think, oh, I have to go get through Jeffrey Hopkins' book, you know. And if you're that persistent, probably you would see emptiness, you know. You know, it's not like that, okay. You need other kinds of, by the way, it's a great book. I'm not gonna say, it's a very great book. Not talking anything like that. You have to, there are other conditions that you need if you want to see emptiness. People are always coming to me and saying, in this life, all I want to do is see emptiness directly. And I say, God bless you. Those are the sweetest words I ever heard. You know, you got your priorities straight. You know, if you don't do anything in this life, if you can just see emptiness directly, you're a genius. You know, that's a music to my ears, okay? The process begins with J, you know, with the Lord. And, you know, sometimes Tibetan books seem to be a little like, I don't know, they seem to be a little too exaggerated for us. Sometimes if you read a biography of a great lama in Tibetan, you could just switch the name and it would be somebody else's biography. You know, at a young age, he showed extraordinary signs. His mother had great dreams. He undertook all the things necessary to become a great lama, and he is the greatest lama we ever had. And you're dying to find out, when was he born? What did he study, you know? What was his meditations like? And they don't tell you. It's just, oh, he's so wonderful, you know? And then you're like, give me some hard information here, you know? What did he really do, you know? What did he study? What did he meditate about? Who was his teachers? So try to see through that. At a certain point, you'll feel like that about Aryan Lamas. I'm not saying you won't. You will. And the people who haven't got their own Lamas, they won't understand you. They'll say you're mushy-headed or something, you know. They'll say you're naive or something. But I'm talking about, this line means the very first stage in seeing emptiness is you have to find a teacher and you have to serve them properly, okay? And I'm being very frank. You know, you are professional Dharma students, most of you. I'm not talking in San Francisco to a general group or something like that. If you want to see emptiness directly, you need two things to start with. You definitely need the right instructions from a person who understands it and who has perceived it, you know? You must find a person like that. You have to seek around the world to find a person like that. And then secondly, you have to become very, very close to them. And you have to have this relationship, this very intimate relationship with them. And that's all, you know. You need that. You must have that, okay? And, you know, we are restricted by our homes, by our families, by our jobs, by our careers, by the city we're living in. You know, you feel like that's your main priority, and then you'd have to find, the Lama would have to come to you and not you go to the Lama. You know what I mean? Like, if you're already in a nice surfing town in San Diego, and the Lama is in this grossest state in the Union, New Jersey, and you feel like, could they just move out to San Diego, you know? There's no surf in New Jersey. I don't care what Ian says. You know, but you have to make a decision like that, you know. You have to, frankly, you have to find them and you have to glue yourself to them. And the virtue required to see emptiness. There's the meditative platform, right, is one thing. But the energy, the karmic energy required to see emptiness directly, requires some very powerful virtue with your root lama. And you have to find a person who really, really fits your personality. I mean, this should become an important part of your life, is trying to locate this person. There are many, many highly qualified lamas. I mean, it's not enough, but there are a lot, you know, relatively speaking, in the world. And you have to find the one that fits your personality and your level. And it won't be the same for everybody, you know. And different people need different lamas. But in the end, you have to find a lama. And you have to decide and you have to commit to them. If you can't find the one that fits you, then you have to go looking. It's the Holy Grail thing all over again, you know. You have to be Lancelot and get on your horse and start looking. And there's no time, you know what I mean? You don't have time to wait, you know, like wait for the right lama to show up in Boulder Creek, California. Although probably there's been more great lamas here than actually you can sit here and wait. I don't want to get heavy or anything, but you have to find them, and it has to become a priority of your life. And don't be satisfied. Find the one that fits you correct. Don't go like, you hear a lama teach once and then you run after them and say, be my root lama, and you know, 6 weeks later you find a better one or something like that. You know, you have to investigate. This is a dangerous thing. This is your mental real estate is very sensitive, and your spiritual real estate, and they have to be authentic. They have to be well trained. They have to know what they're talking about. And don't do it easily. Don't go into the relationship easily, but you must seek that relationship. And that's what the first verse here is about. You know, this is Jetsun Kapa. And he's describing to you the first thing you need. And you can't see emptiness unless you have the virtue that comes from being in direct relationship with your root lama. You have to find them. You have to go find them, okay? And it's a priority of your life. You don't have time, and whatever you're holding back for will disappear anyway. You know what I mean? So you have to find them. Okay. Yunin Kungi Shigyu means it's that lama's instructions that bring you all your ability to meditate properly, all your ability to see emptiness, all your ability to get bodhicitta. They are the source for that ability. And you need to be in that relationship with them. If you're not, if you can't find them, and this is very common, you know, you can't find them or they're far away, you can't be with them, do some heavy-duty prayers like Jetsun Kapa did, okay? What do you think he was doing camping out at the foot of Atisha's feet, you know? I mean, he was praying to meet this person. He was praying to meet this being, you know, and you have to, if you can't find them right now or the circumstances don't fit right now, then spend a lot of your energy praying for them, praying to meet them. My lama, one of my lamas taught me this. I had this lama, I wanted to be close to them, and it looked impossible. You know, I mean, the circumstances were impossible. And so they taught me this prayer to do every night before I went to bed, you know. And I really did do it, you know. It's like, now I lay me down to sleep or something, you know. Every night I would do this prayer. And it worked, you know. It really does work, okay? Does it work from their side? No, okay? They are not self-existent. It's the power of the prayer forces them to come to your town. Okay? It forces them to appear. Forces this lama to appear. So if you don't have a root lama, do some prayer every night. Go into this meditation and visualize what they would be like. And then pray that they come to you. Okay? And do it very, very, very sincerely. Every night before you sleep. And then the virtue of that, the goodness of that, makes them appear, forces them to come. I always tell people, especially a tantric lama, like you can't put an ad in the newspaper and say, wanted qualified tantric master, don't know who you are since you're secret, but, please call, that's not how to get them, it's a very subtle thing. You get them by practicing properly. You force them to appear. It's like honey to a fly, and you make your mind sweet enough, they must come to you, You're like drawing them like with a magnet, and your personal tantric master will appear, but you have to reel them in with your practice, by keeping your book. Okay, best way, all right? Okay, Shigyo Dinshin Shin. Yunden means good quality. Kun means all. Shigyo means the source. You who are the source. Dinshin Jay means my kind lord. Okay? Oh, it's in reading 5. Okay. Don't tell them that or they won't write it. Okay. The next one is TSUL. SHIN. TENPA. LAM. GYI. TSAWA RU. Say Tsushin, Temba, Lamki, Sawa, Ru. Okay. Tsushin Temba means. Tsushin means properly, in the proper way. Temba is a very difficult word to translate. You tell me. It's what you do with medicine to get it to cure you. It's what you do with the direction manual so that you can do what you have to do. It's what you do with a doctor so that they can help you. It's what you do with the lama in this, in this practice. I don't know. It's not Bruten, okay? Those of you who are studying Tibetan, it's not Brten. It's Bisten, and it's unusual. It means to... It's the word in Tibetan for taking medicine. It's the word in Tibetan for following the instructions of a physician. It's the word in Tibetan for using an instruction manual. You see what I mean? It's the word in Tibetan for serving someone properly. All of those meanings. I can't decide, actually. To me, it sounds like... exploitation, utilize your lama, and I'm tempted to translate it that way. I really am tempted. I think that's kind of what it means to employ. You could almost say depend on your lama, like you depend on medicine or you depend on a physician or you rely upon a physician or rely might not be too bad, but all those, what's that? Cooperate and what else? You could say that. It's all of those things, you see. There's no one word in English. I don't know. Anyway, what it means is relate to them properly, in the proper way. Have the proper relationship with them. This is very, very, very difficult, okay? It's, yeah, I mean, we'll talk about it, It's very, very, very difficult. I mean, the situation's like this. Like, they're supposedly, okay, they're this enlightened being. You know, they're a tantric angel. And they have emanated as a normal person who picks their nose and burps once in a while and gets mad at you once in a while. They try to look human to make you comfortable. You know what I mean? And then you're studying with them. And in the monastery, the lama has to pay all your expenses, you know. Once they take you as a student in the monastery, you sleep in their rooms. They have to feed you. They have to dress you. They have to take you to school. They have to send you to your classes. They have to make sure you're studying well. You know, they have to interface with your parents and everybody else for you. And they don't get paid at all. They don't get anything. You're just more burden to them. You see what I mean? And I don't mean by proper relationship that you bow down at the right time and other unnatural things. You know what I mean? There's lots of students I've seen bow down to their lamas and then talk behind their back and refuse to help them in a substantial way, you know, and stuff like that. Not like that. It's really some very affectionate relationship where you're trying very hard to follow what they're teaching you. You know what I mean? And what makes them happy. A good lama, the day I went to my lama, bowed down before his feet, said, "Na sang ge gu." You know, he always makes fun of me. "I need Buddha." You know, and I offered him my bank book. And he said, "What's this?" I said, "Bank book, I have this much money, you know, and my mother died, I have an inheritance." He says, "Here, you take it. You know, you need it, you know." And they don't want that stuff. You know, they don't need that stuff. What they really want out of you is that you try very hard to do what they tell you to do. You know what I mean? And that's the relationship, okay? That's the main relationship. You know, they are teaching you, and you are working on your own mind. Well, keeping the book is a really, really powerful way to rely upon a lama, you know. That's all they really want out of you. They don't need your money. If they've seen emptiness directly, they don't need a thing from you. You know, they're all taken care of for the rest of their life, you know. All they really want is that you be happy, you know. And every time you have another mental affliction, every time you're grumpy, every time you don't do your meditation, it just makes them sad. You make them sad. So really, proper behavior towards a lama is to practice well. Practice what they ask you to do. And come back in a year and say, "I love it." You know, people come up to me, see this little stack of books here. The really good students I have. Can I? Yeah. This makes lamas happy. You know, you want Lama Sopa's health to improve? You know, this is somebody's book for the last year. You know, they learned the book last year, and they kept it every single day. I love this stuff, you know. And then your lamas get really happy. Because you can't write down your successes and your failures for a year and not make some spiritual progress, you know. It forces you to make spiritual progress, you know. And then they're really happy. I have other students who say, "I'm not going to keep a book, but here's some money," you know, or something like that. It's not the point, you know. You want the book, okay? That's what they really want, okay? If they're building Dharma centers, it's not for them, you know. Lama Sopa doesn't need another center, you know. It's just another headache for him. You know, if he asks you to help build a center or take care of a center, you think he needs it? You know, it's not for him, it's for you. It's for you and your brothers and sisters. And, you know, don't think all he's getting is 10 more emails and 3 more phone calls every day about the problem at the center, you know. You know. Okay? So really, to do what they ask. Okay. All right. To learn, to follow the practices. To learn to meditate, for example. You know. Lam Gitsawa, Lam means the Buddhist path. Tsawa means the root of the Buddhist path. Okay. And what it means is finding a qualified lama, trying to stay close to them and serve them well, to truly help them as much as you can, and to work on your own mind in an honest way, a sincere way. That is the root of all the Buddhist paths. You want to see emptiness, that's where you start. And I meet a lot of people who say, I don't want to build another stupa for Lama Sopa. I want to study, you know. But you don't get it then. You know, you need both, okay? You need to study, and you must be serving some Lama, okay? And that's how you get the good karma to see emptiness directly. And I emphasize again, they don't need it, you know. They don't need another center. They don't need your money. They don't need whatever you can do. It's not for them. It's for you. Okay? That's the point, is to collect good karma for yourself so you can see emptiness directly. Okay? And no matter how much you understand intellectually, if you don't have this relationship with a lama and you're not contributing or serving them, you cannot see emptiness directly. It's as important as the meditation. Okay? The English letters here are Lekpar, Lekpar. Tongne, Tongne. Bepa is Bepa. Duma is Duma. And Yi is Yi. You can compare being around a qualified lama. If you've ever studied music or dance or math or computers or anything, I mean, if you want to reach a serious level, Tonglam, seeing emptiness directly, is a lot like being a concert pianist. It's a lot like being able to dance a good dance performance. It's a lot like being able to solve advanced algebra or differential equations, you know. It's a lot like learning physics. And to think that you could do that on your own, to think that you could just read some books about it, it's impossible. Don't think that being a master meditator and seeing emptiness directly require any less skill than those things. You know, you need training. You need to be at the foot of a master. And they have to train you, seriously. The odds of, you know, just happening to see emptiness directly are something like just happening to be able to play Rachmaninoff, by good luck, you know. You know, it's not like that. You have to be trained. You have to be trained in a serious way. Okay. Lekpa tong means, hey, look, see it. See that that is the case. Tong means see it. Lekpa means with certainty and well, you know, figure it out. You have to see that directly. You have to understand that is the root of the Buddhist path. You must find a master like that, and you must get trained with them. Okay. Tongne means once you've seen it. Bepa Duma means you have to work hard. Okay. Bepa means effort. Duma means many efforts. It means you have to work hard. I've seen many people study different things, like when I was in college, they studied dance, you know, and they would go to this great master, Zeba Cohen, and she would give them these incredible instructions, and then maybe three people in the whole class would end up to be incredible dancers, and then the rest would go home and not do anything until the next class. And it's the same kind of principle, you know. Bepa Duma means they can be great from their side. They can be, you know, the piano teacher of the century. But you got to do your scales, you know. And sometimes it's not so much fun, you know, to do scales all day long. And when you're training, you have to put out the effort. The Sakyapanita said, first thing my lama made me memorize, Kepa Lobe Duna Du, Dera Duna Kemi Si, you know, wise men suffer during their training years. they were doing the KMC. If you want to be wise, if you want to just stay pleasant and happy and not work too hard, KMC, you'll never be a great meditator. It's impossible. You have to, no pain, no gain. Okay? You have to put out the effort. After they teach a nice weekend course on how to meditate, if you don't go down and sit down that cushion for a few months, hard, day after day, then yeah, you don't expect much, you know. Don't expect much. Dharma results are exactly commensurate to your efforts. And there's no magic, and there's no easy way, and there's no magic, you know. It's plain old sweat. And it means meditating when you don't feel like meditating, and meditating when you don't have time to meditate, and meditating when your family and everybody else thinks you're crazy, okay? All of those things, you got to put out the effort. Okay, Bepa Dumi. And now the last line, then we'll quit. The English letters here are G-U-P-A. C-H-E-N. P-U. C-H-E-N. P-U. L-O-P. P-A-R. I'm sorry. Change the L-O-P to T-E-N, okay? J-I-N, G-Y-I, L-O-B. Gupa Chembo means with great respect, okay? With great respect. Dembar means to, that's that word, okay? rely on them, or take myself to them, or take them to me, or I don't know. Jingilob means please bless me. Who's saying that? Who's saying please bless me? Jetam Kapa. To whom? Alisha and all the lamas of the lineage back to the Lord Buddha, and he's having this acid trip, and he's like, bless me, you know. He's like, all of these lamas are covering, they say it was like up in the sky in front of him, all in the air in front of him, and they're like, he's like, wow, you know, please give me your blessings, you know. Please give me your blessings, okay. Bless me that I can make many efforts to serve my lama and learn with my lama with great respect, okay. And great respect, there's a debate in the Abhidharma. It's very interesting. The difference between attachment and respect. It's very interesting. Attachment in this case would be some kind of attitude that would make you, any kind of attitude towards your lama which could turn into some kind of bad feelings. You see what I mean? Like getting jealous at another student of your lama or something like that. Okay? That's attachment towards your lama. Okay? Anything where you think you have to defend your lama against other people, you know what I mean, is a mental affliction. That's attachment, okay? So Master Shantideva has a beautiful line. Somebody says, can I do violence if someone's hurting my lama? He says, no. And they say, why not? This is important. And he says, listen, if your lama's already seen emptiness, if they're an enlightened being, they don't need your protection, okay? If they're not an enlightened being, they're at the mercy of their karma. Okay, so in either case, it's improper for you to. You don't have to get jealous or angry or any kind of negativity, any kind of mental affliction, that any kind of attitude towards your lama that would make you have a mental affliction is not kupa. It's not respect. Okay, respect here is something different. So that in the Abhidharma, they talk about you have to be able to distinguish between respect for your lama and attachment to your lama. Okay, attachment means any kind of attitude towards your lama which could be perverted into anger at another student or jealousy at another student or any feeling like bad feeling towards other people. the real respect is something that's close to affection. You know, you serve them deeply, you hang out with them all the time, you're constantly getting these sweet, sweet, sweet dharma from them. You're doing your best to give them everything they need, to allow them to teach other people. You're not possessive of them, you're not jealous of them, you're facilitating their mission, helping them serve other people. You know, somebody asked me, we waited for almost 10 years for His Holiness to get his visa to come here the first time. The State Department would not give him a visa to come to the United States. And we waited and waited and waited. I'll never forget, I was in a Mongolian family's home when he got his visa. The announcement came, you know, ran through our community like fire. You know, His Holiness is coming, you know. Finally, he's got granted his visa. And this Mongolian lady says to me, it's so wonderful, His Holiness is coming. Where will you be when he gets here? You'll probably be right up in the front. I said, I know where I'll be. I'll be in the kitchen making momos, you know. And I was. And you have to be satisfied. That's your relationship. That's what they need. You do it. You see what I mean? And you're happy. And you feel privileged. And you're joyful. And you're sitting there in the kitchen and you're making momos for His Holiness. And you're not like worrying about the people flowing up to see Him in Ken Rinpoche's room. And, you know, and just quietly making the momos. Then what happens? Somebody comes down and grabs you and says, hey, you've been sitting here making momos all night. You get to meet him personally, you know. And that's what happened. You know, and that's the Guru Yoga, you see. That's the proper way. That's respect. You have this love, trust, you know, whatever they say, you do happily. You're not jealous. You're not worried about what else is going on with other people. You just, it's a one-on-one relationship. And you personally are, you feel this just, it's not, you know, when you say respect, you think of Kung Fu and David, what's his name, you know, like that, and you know, and this equals respect, you know. It's not like that. The real feeling you get is just a sort of affection for each other, and this good feeling, you know. They've been giving you this sweet, sweet, sweet Dharma teachings. You've been trying as hard as you can, and you've had many failures to do what they ask you to do. And then you have a good time helping them, serving them, and then you get this constant feedback from them, you know, and it creates this alpha cycle or whatever, you know, alpha waves, you know, and you're serving them and they're feeding you and you get more happy and you serve them and then they're more happy, so they give you more instructions, they give you the secret instructions, and then you give them more momos, and then you get the, you know, secret instructions, and you know, and You help the other students get access to your lama. You help them. You're happy with them. You support each other, and this is just, that's real respect. Okay, it's not like you bow to the right degree or something like that. It's not like that. Okay, then there's a sweet feeling around the lama. I mean, Lama Yeshe, the feeling around him was like that. The feeling around Lama Sepa is like that. You know, that's the right way. Okay, we'll stop there. And then what time tomorrow? I think early, right? We have to start at 9 tomorrow if we're going to get in the dinner that you're and if we're going to get in the refuge vows. Tomorrow, when we do the refuge and the layman's vows, a couple of things. If you're not sure if you want to take it or not, I encourage you to come and listen. Okay? I'll go over the 12 refuge commitments carefully. I'll go over the 5 layman's commitments carefully. There's a technicality, there's a fine print in the layman's vow contract. Nachik Naga, Pyeojo Chu, Yonzo Judan, Sangju Dan, Kamdugini, number 2, which says, technically speaking, you can take only 1 of the 5, or 2 of the 5, or 3 of the 5. I don't do that. Okay? Okay? You either take all 5 or you don't take all 5. You know? I'll explain all 5 tomorrow, clearly. And then if you feel like it's something you can take, that's fine. The main commitment you're making when you take refuge is to act in a compassionate way to other people, you know, and to get your rear end into ecstasy of Buddha paradise as fast as possible. So that's not like, it's not like I'm going to show you some picture of some Gautama guy and you have to swear allegiance to him forever. Or it's not like that, okay? All they want out of you is that you get enlightened quick. And that you are compassionate to other beings all the time. Those are the main purpose, function, and content of those commitments, okay? Yeah? She said, if you come to the ceremony and you know, suddenly you get inspired and say, okay, I'll take those. What point do you have to say, you know, I do? It's like this. I'll go through the explanation carefully of the refuge, and then I'll give you an opportunity. I'll go through both explanations first. Then we'll do refuge commitment, and then we'll do lifetime layman's vows. Actually, refuge is a part of lifetime layman's vows. Okay, so we'll do that, and then as I recite the ceremony, you'll have to recite back to me like 3 times something in Tibetan, and I'll explain to you what you're saying. It's not like I agree to sign over my car to you in 3 weeks or something. It's not like that, okay? And it's like I'll repeat it, and you repeat it 3 times. So I'll say, anyone who wants to take refuge now, repeat now. And then anyone who wants to take lifetime layman's vows, do it now. Okay, and it'll be like that. You're very welcome to come, even if you don't intend to take them, because it will be a very heavy good karma. It'll be a blessing to be in that place. You're very welcome to come if you've already taken them, but you cannot take them again. Okay, once you've taken them, they exist in your mind stream until you die. There's only two ways to lose your vows, pratimoksha vows. Lapapu, give them back or die. Or change sexes 3 times, okay? So, you know, not a problem, right? So like that. I mean, you cannot take them again, you know, once you've taken them, unless you've given them back or something like that, all right? If you've taken some and you want to take them all, I'm happy to give you the rest. Okay, like that, all right? People have asked me, you know, I mean, the main ones are not to kill a human, not to steal anything of major value, not to commit direct, obvious adultery with another person's sworn wife or husband, you know, not to lie about your spiritual life, especially to say you've seen emptiness when you haven't seen it, and not to use drugs or alcohol at all, okay? So a lot of people come up to me and say, I wasn't planning to kill anybody. Man, before you started that book thing, I was planning it. And now I don't want to have to write it in the book, you know. So, you know, why should I take a vow? I mean, I'm not the kind of person who's going to go killing people. But it's much, much more powerful good karma if you take a vow. Much more powerful. And so you get all this good karma from having this vow that you're never going to break anyway. And it's intense good karma. It's the kind of karma that gets you into a Buddha field in this lifetime. Okay, it has an immense effect on your mind stream. Okay, and easy to keep. I mean, what I just said. I mean, no one in this place is planning to do any of that stuff. Okay, and it's easy. Those are not so hard to keep. They're not like bodhisattva vows. I think Atisha said, my pratimoksha vows are perfectly clean. My bodhisattva vows are like a light rain. My tantric vows are like a hailstorm. Okay. All right, we'll stop there.
Okay. No good and dashina chepa Gurana Mandala Kamrayataya Dijawaka Sanami Shetodashi Sanami